Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the constitutional right to counsel. And we mean by that the requirement that has been put on states and state courts by the Supreme Court that they're required to provide attorneys to criminal defendants who can't afford them. There is a lot of evidence, and we'll talk about it, that in spite of the fact that funding for this effort has been increased in recent decades, there's a lot of evidence that shows that the money that's been set aside to provide counsel for people who can't afford their own lawyers is just not adequate. And in fact, overall, the effort is just not adequate. We will be talking this morning in this hour of Focus with Norman Lefstein. He's professor of law and dean emeritus at Indiana University School of Law in Indianapolis. And he is a contributor to a recent report. This is something that has come out of something called the Constitution Project, which is overall a large effort looking at various important constitutional legal questions. They have a number of committees, and one of the committees is the Right to Counsel Committee that has generated this report. And our guest, Professor Lefstein, is a member of that committee. It's something that you can read online if you go to the website of the Constitution Project. They have issued a very detailed report there, so if you're interested in reading more about the subject, you can do that. We'll try and cover some of the basics this morning, and also we'll be taking questions from people who are listening. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. He has served as director of the Public Defender Service for the District of Columbia. He's been an assistant U.S. attorney and also staff member in the Office of the Deputy Attorney General of the U.S. Department of Justice. His publications include Criminal Defense Services for the Poor, which was published by the American Bar Association in 1982. He co-authored Gideon's Broken Promise, America's Continuing Quest for Equal Justice. That was published by the ABA in 2004. He's served as a member of the Bar Association's Standing Committee on Legal Aid and Indigent Defendants for 9 years, also chaired its Indigent Defense Advisory Group, and in 2007, he concluded 17 years as the chairman of the Indiana Public Defender Commission. As we talk, questions are welcome. We just ask people who are calling in to keep their comments and questions brief, so we can keep moving along and hope people will be on the topic in what they have to say. But questions, comments are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point, questions are welcome. Professor Lefstein, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, at least in Indianapolis. I think it's still morning in Champaign.
It's still morning in Champaign. Well, thanks very much for talking with us. I want to get into this in some detail, and certainly we can talk about the right to counsel and where it comes from and so forth, and we'll do that. Maybe to start, if I ask the question, where are we now with fulfilling this charge that has come down from the court, this promise that will provide representation to people who need it if they can't afford it. Overall, right now, how are we doing?
Well, there's no question that since the most important of the Supreme Court's decisions, namely the famous Gideon decision in 1963, and there were other cases after that that were important as well, we've made progress since 1963, now more than 45 years later, but we're still not doing very well. And in many states, the problems are really terrible because you have inadequate funding and sometimes a lack of sufficient independence for the defense function. You have lawyers who are trying to handle way too many cases to really do the kind of work on behalf of their clients they ought to be doing. And in the lower courts especially, you sometimes have defendants who relinquish or give up their right to a lawyer in certain circumstances where they really ought not to do so, but they don't fully understand, I'm fearful sometimes, of what it is they are giving up. And so you have courts that proceed in many, many cases without lawyers at all. But it really flies beneath the radar screen and doesn't come much to the attention of appellate courts and sometimes to the public.
Mm-hmm. And does this, the obligation to provide counsel, does this apply to anyone charged with any crime?
Well, it certainly applies in felony cases. It applies in misdemeanor cases for anyone who is, at least as a constitutional matter, who's actually imprisoned, although many states have interpreted it even more broadly and said that the lawyers will be provided in misdemeanor cases. And it certainly applies in juvenile delinquency cases. Somebody under the age of 18, if that's the age of majority in the state, who's charged with juvenile being a delinquent is entitled to legal representation, much the same as an adult would be in the felony and misdemeanor cases to which I referred. There also are some other kinds of cases where states have required lawyers to be provided, even though they are not technically required to be provided as a constitutional matter.
Mm-hmm. And I think that it's the case that over time there has been, as far as the court is concerned, the Supreme Court, there has been some expansion in their requirements for what sort of person charged with what sort of crime needs to have representation. So there was at least something a little bit specific saying how this is supposed to work. But other than that, it is a problem here that the court has been maybe a little short on the details about exactly what needs to be provided?
Well, I think that's exactly right, although it's entirely understandable. After all, the Supreme Court of the United States, which has been instrumental in setting forth the constitutional right to counsel, which is really the interpretation of the Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution, which is applicable to state governments and local jurisdictions, the Supreme Court is not a legislature. The Supreme Court announced the constitutional right to counsel, made it clear that it applies, but exactly how it was to be implemented, how it was to be paid for, the kinds of programs necessary to make sure that individuals were adequately represented was something that the Supreme Court did not spell out, and I suppose in the nature of Supreme Court decision-making is not the kind of thing the Supreme Court normally would address. And so since the Supreme Court's decisions were rendered beginning in the 1960s, I think it's fair to say that state and local governments have wrestled with how to deliver on this constitutional right to an attorney.
One of the problems that I know that you have identified is that sometimes the attorney comes in to the process kind of late. You would think the ideal would be from as soon as you possibly could, after somebody was charged, an attorney would become involved so they can become familiar with the person in the case and provide them with representation right from the beginning. But that doesn't always happen. There are cases where people have to sit in jail waiting for an attorney. And I'm sure that there are cases where the first time the attorney sees the client is the first time that they appear before a judge. What has the court said about that? And in fact, has the court said anything about how that's supposed to be worked out and when exactly they are expecting the lawyer to show up?
Well, the court has addressed that issue on a couple of occasions, most recently and perhaps most importantly in a decision within the past year that came from a case in Texas. And what the court has said is, and this gets rather technical, but what the Supreme Court has said is that the right to counsel attaches to the defendant when the defendant initially appears in court and there is the commencement of adversary proceedings. And as a practical matter, what that means is that the defendant really is entitled to counsel at that first court appearance. Normally that is what happens, unless, of course, the defendant waives the right to counsel. And when I say waive the right to counsel, the way it should be done, if the defendant gives up the right to an attorney, is with a formal inquiry by the court as to whether or not the defendant understands that there is the right to an attorney, the right to an attorney at state expense if they cannot afford counsel, and a very clear inquiry about whether or not the person wants to be represented by a lawyer. Sometimes that inquiry doesn't proceed very fully, and sometimes it's very quick, and sometimes lawyers are not available. At least that's been a problem in some jurisdictions, that first court appearance has not talked to the defendant prior to the court appearance to find out whether release pending disposition of the case might be possible. So there have been problems, especially in the lower courts, on delivering of that right to counsel.
Well, in a case like that, I'm sure that there are probably a lot of places, too, where the need for attorneys to serve in this role is simply far outstrips the number of attorneys who are available, willing, able, actually, to do it.
Well, this is where I think funding comes into play. The public often believes that there's no shortage of lawyers in the United States. And indeed, I don't think there is a shortage of lawyers in the United States. There may be, however, and indeed I would argue that there is, a lack of adequate funding for counsel. And that has led, I think, sometimes to not having a sufficient number of public defenders. And it also has meant that private lawyers who take cases typically by assignment of the court and receive some kind of fee for handling cases sometimes receive very inadequate fees for the time they spend, and that in turn tends to drive out the very best attorneys from providing representation in indigent criminal and juvenile cases. And indeed, I think there's considerable evidence that the history of the public defender movement in the United States is that the caseloads have outstripped the capacity of public defender programs who have been trying to handle too many cases in many jurisdictions, with the result that fewer and fewer members of the private bar are available to provide representation, and they in turn are not well compensated for their efforts.
Does the court say anything about what is appropriate compensation, or is that left completely up to the local jurisdictions?
It really is left up to the local jurisdiction, or to the state, if it's a statewide program. And what I mean by that is that there are some states in the United States, maybe about 28 of them right now, where there is some kind of an overall statewide program to furnish defense services in criminal and juvenile cases. In other states, there may be some kind of a hybrid program to furnish representation involving the states and local jurisdictions. Probably in two states in the United States, it is all up to the counties. I realize many of your listeners are in Illinois, and in Illinois, most of the representation is funded by the counties, although there is a state appellate defender office in the state of Illinois. But I would not put Illinois among the 28 jurisdictions I referred to a moment ago that have a statewide program. That's a comprehensive program for furnishing representation.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Norman Lefstein. He's professor of law and dean emeritus of the Indiana University School of Law in Indianapolis. And we're talking about the right to counsel and how well, as a nation, we are doing in fulfilling this commitment that says if a person is accused of a crime, charged with a crime, that if they can't afford an attorney, that we'll provide one for them. What we're talking about is some of what you'll find in a recent report. This is a report of the National Right to Counsel Committee. That's a committee of the Constitution Project, titled Justice Denied, America's Continuing Neglect of Our Constitutional Right to Counsel. Our guest, Professor Lefstein, was a member of this committee, the Right to Counsel Committee. And if you go to the website of the Constitution Project, if you'd like to read their report, you can do that. Questions are also welcome here, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. I suppose there are two ways that jurisdictions could provide this legal service. There could be a public defender, an office, a public defender office, where you have people that's their job. That's what they do. They defend indigent defendants. Or you could contract that, and you could say to all of the attorneys in private practice there, you would say, all right, we will pay this much money for you to do this job and see who might come forward. How, as you look across the country, I guess I'm just curious, are there more public defenders, or are there more private attorneys who are doing this on a contractual basis?
Well, I can't give you precise numbers. I think it's fair to say that in the United States, we have increasingly relied upon organized offices of public defenders, the theory being that lawyers in a public defender office can develop expertise, there can be some economies of scale. On the other hand, it's important to emphasize you can't operate a system for indigent defense representation without also having private bar representation. Those have to be private attorneys who are paid a fee or enter into some kind of a contract to take a certain number of cases. Sometimes a law firm will do that. In some jurisdictions. The reason why I say you have to have both is that there always will be conflict of interest cases where you have multiple defendants where really the defender office really should only be handling one of the clients because you can have a situation where once you have multiple defendants in a criminal case, for example, one may accuse the other. The situations are never the same for each defendant, and the courts have cautioned lawyers that usually there is a conflict of interest when you have multiple clients. So you've got to have a presence of the private bar. You need to have the presence of the private bar in some fashion to serve as an escape valve for the public defender becoming overloaded with cases. That has not always happened, but that's really what you need. And in that sense, I might add, we are very much unlike England, for example. England does not rely on public defenders at all. England uses the private bar to provide representation in these same kinds of cases, and those lawyers have to be certified by a national commission. And they receive fees that are paid by the National Commission in England. This is not a subject, incidentally, that is covered in our report. I mention it simply to indicate that the way the programs have developed in the United States versus England are very different, because I've also spent some time studying the English system.
Well, just let me ask you this, and I have a caller here. I'll get to this person in a moment. This may not be a question that you can answer just because, you know, it's a big country and there are a lot of jurisdictions. Is it possible to say anything about particularly, let's say, just say public defenders, what their caseloads are, how many people that they're having to represent, and what sort of living they're able to make out of being a public defender?
It is extremely hard to generalize. Mm-hmm. There are some places where the caseloads are under control and the salaries are reasonable, and maybe a few where they're rather good. But I think overall, many, many public defenders in the United States are overwhelmed with cases. Sometimes the salaries are inadequate. I testified as an expert witness in a case down in Florida, and one of the leaders of that office testified about the fact that they had lawyers from that office who were taking part-time jobs, even though they were overwhelmed with cases in the office. They were taking part-time jobs in order to supplement their salaries because they were paid so poorly. They had law school debts and other responsibilities. So in general, there are problems. We said in our report that there are places where the caseloads are astonishingly high, where at any given time a lawyer may have over 100 clients to represent. I had a lawyer for a public defender office in a northeastern community in the United States in a populous state who told me that he was simultaneously asked to represent over 325 clients at a given time, and he had no idea how to do it. And that is the kind of situation that sometimes arises. And I told him that what he really needed to do was to go to the heads of the office and try to get some relief. And if necessary, and this is an ethical requirement, to ask the court to permit him to withdraw from some of those cases. And the head of the office actually threatened to fire him if he did that, because the head of the office was under enormous political pressures not to rock the boat. And that is, I mentioned that as an example of the sorts of political problems that arise when you don't have an independent defense function.
Yeah. We have some callers here. Let's talk with them. We'll start with someone here in Champaign County where we are. This is our line number one. Hello.
Hi. I had had one point when I called in, but subsequent to listening, I wanted to ask about one thing. It seems to me that you mentioned the British counterexample or comparisons. It seems to me that an international body of jurists issued a report on justice in the U.S. I don't know if it was a U.N. or was just some kind of independent. And it was rather scathing. I don't think that the U.S. responds well to criticism outside, so I applaud your own work for bringing it to the attention. But it's pretty scandalous, it seems to me. On the local level, I wanted to point out that there's a phenomenon called community court watch in this town, and I think there are some other places, too, where community people are just so concerned about some of the statistics in the region that show differential representation and sentencing and the whole even differential indicting, you know, where so but I wanted you to comment on whether you surveyed that as a phenomenon at all. And but from the very beginning, you mentioned this people falling through the cracks and no lawyers being involved. I think there's case could be made that there's a phenomenon called coercive plea bargaining, where given the lack of representation that's available at any reasonable cost and the long lines that and the lack of attention that the poor overworked public defenders have, that plea bargaining seems to be the route of most cases. And I don't know if you have the statistics on that on the top of your head, but why I call it coercive is because prosecutors know how dismal the representation is, and they basically throw the book at somebody and then offer a plea bargain that you know, may be something that you know, will plague the person for the rest of their life, but and brand them, but it won't be as bad as, you know, doing some heavy time. I hope that's focused enough for you, and I'll hang up and listen if you would. Thanks.
Sure. Well, you mentioned a couple of things. You mentioned an international report. And I confess I'm not familiar with the report to which you refer. I suspect it more likely had to do with the treatment of Guantanamo detainees rather than the area that we're talking about today, namely criminal and juvenile defense representation, because I don't believe there has been any kind of an international report respecting the way our justice system functions in the run-of-the-mill kinds of cases we're talking about. You mentioned a community court watch program operating locally. There are, I know, such programs in various parts of the country. I think they're very, very positive to have programs of that kind because things change sometimes in the court systems when there is public scrutiny. We like to think that the report we produced, which is probably the most extensive report on indigent defense that's been done since the 1970s, will be positive and will help to contribute to change over time. But locally, community watch groups, I think, are extremely important, especially when they issue reports and sometimes through that process bring pressure to bear. The notion of coercive plea bargaining, it's not a term we use in the report, but we do talk about incidents that occur where defendants are really essentially told, and we think it raises all kinds of ethical issues for prosecutors, are essentially told by judges or by other court personnel that before they talk to a lawyer, they've got to talk to the prosecutor. And the prosecutor, and I think this is contrary to rules of ethics, sometimes will offer plea arrangements to defendants. They forego the right to an attorney in order to maybe get out of jail that day or otherwise forego their right to a lawyer. It may have collateral consequences of a kind they haven't considered. And that's what I meant earlier when I talked about courts where counsel is not always really offered to the defendant in a way that counsel should be offered or the right to counsel is waived in a process that really short-circuits what is required as a legal matter.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here. This is Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and the guest is Norman Lefstein. He's professor of law and dean emeritus of the Indiana University School of Law, Indianapolis. He served as director of the Public Defender Service for the District of Columbia. He also has been an assistant U.S. attorney, a staff member in the Office of the Deputy Attorney General of the U.S. Department of Justice. He's authored Criminal Defense Services for the Poor, published by the ABA, American Bar Association, in 1982. Also co-authored Gideon's Broken Promise, America's Continuing Quest for Equal Justice, also published by the ABA in 2004. He has served as member of the Bar Association's Standing Committee on Legal Aid and Indigent Defendants. He did that for 9 years, also chaired its Indigent Defense Advisory Group. In 2007, he concluded a period of 17 years as the chairman of the Indiana Public Defender Commission. He is a member of the Right to Counsel, National Right to Counsel Committee of the Constitution Project, and they are the ones that put out this report that he mentioned, Justice Denied, America's Continuing Neglect of Our Constitutional Right to Counsel. And if you want to read it, you can go to the website of the Constitution Project, which is www.constitutionproject.org, and you can see it there. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Perhaps a bottom-line question that I should ask here is, do you believe that there are significant numbers of individuals who were convicted of crimes that they did not commit as simply as a result of having poor representation?
Well, there's no question that there are persons who are convicted in our criminal justice system in the United States who are innocent. And And since the first case involving DNA evidence, which dates back to 1989, we've learned in ways we never conclusively could show before that genuinely innocent people do get convicted while the real perpetrator of the crime is permitted to go free. The extent to which inadequate counsel contributes to wrongful convictions is a more difficult question, but I think the proper answer is this. If you look at the various reasons that wrongful convictions occur, they occur as a result of mistaken eyewitness identifications, false confessions, faulty scientific evidence that is not challenged. There's a whole litany of reasons that it happens. Sometimes the reason is simply very bad lawyering, which makes it obvious. But whatever the reason is, they are all problems or difficulties in the justice system that very effective defense lawyers can address if they are fully, adequately, and effectively representing their clients. And where you don't have an adequately supported defense lawyer on the other side, you undoubtedly risk ever greater numbers of wrongful convictions. I mean, if you go to the website of the Innocence Project, which is part of the Benjamin Cardozo School of Law in New York, they list on the website the 200-plus cases, I think it's more like 240 now, of defendants who have been wrongfully convicted and freed as a result of DNA evidence. But anyone who thinks that that's the end of the matter, and just those 240 are those who have been wrongfully convicted, I think that's a grave mistake. Because it's clear, I think, to anyone who has carefully studied the situation that the people who have been freed based on DNA evidence in the United States are but the tip of the iceberg. And I say it, and I can illustrate it in a very simple way. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of DNA exonerations have happened, the majority by far have happened, in the cases of sexual assaults. Where there were positive eyewitness identifications, and then DNA evidence came along and proved that the positive eyewitness identification was incorrect, whereas DNA exonerations in robbery cases, where there invariably is a positive eyewitness identification, there are virtually no DNA exonerations in robbery cases, despite the fact that they have invariably been supported in court by positive eyewitness identifications. And you can't look at that data, and it's all been compiled by some researchers at the University of Michigan in a very effective series of articles. It makes a very compelling case for why you need to have an adequate system of indigent defense in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Just to go back to the issue of funding, it seems that an overall issue is that simply that jurisdictions around the country, many of them, simply haven't allocated enough money so that we can have enough attorneys and pay them a reasonable sort of salary to do the work. There are other costs associated with representing someone, I'm sure, that go beyond just the time of the individual, various kinds of ways that you might need to spend money, including having expert testimony, people that you're going to have to pay. What is the situation with that and the ability of public offenders to have some sort of fund like that they can draw on if indeed they need to, they have various kinds of expenses that they need to cover over and above their whatever they're paid per hour or however they're paid for their individual services?
Sure. Well, that's a real problem that you mentioned. There is, as part of the right to counsel, there is a Supreme Court decision that established the right to an expert. The particular case before the court was a psychiatric expert. But courts generally have recognized in a wide variety of cases that a defendant is entitled to various kinds of expert assistance, and obviously you can't effectively represent defendants or juveniles today unless you have access to not only experts but investigators and sometimes social workers. You need staff support and resources, and the extent to which those are available is a problem, like everything else in the indigent defense area. I would venture to say it's gotten better over the years, but it often is very inadequate in terms of the resources that are available. And as a result, experts are not used or they're used sparingly. Cases are not investigated, and that's part of the problem that defense lawyers often run into.
Mm-hmm. We talked earlier about among the reasons that someone might be convicted of a crime that he or she did not commit. One of the reasons you might be convicted is simply that you had a bad lawyer, and that one could have an expensive bad lawyer, someone that you had paid out of your pocket. So part of the issue, I suppose, here could be that we don't have enough good lawyers who are willing to do this work. And I don't mean to be critical. I think you'd have to honor anybody who would make the choice of being a public defender. So it's not intended to be a criticism of that. But at the same time, one has to ask, well, what is the quality of the people who are doing this work? And moreover, is there someone, some entity that is looking at the public defenders, or the people who are doing this work, and trying to provide some sort of oversight of the quality of service that those people are rendering?
Sure. Well, in general, I would say that the vast majority of public defenders in the United States are very dedicated. They're very committed. But even the most talented lawyer in the world is unable to deliver the kind of effective defense services to which the client is entitled when they're overwhelmed with cases and when they lack adequate support. And one of the other things that typically is sacrificed when caseloads are inadequate and the support services are insufficient is a lack of adequate supervision and monitoring of the quality of the work that is being done. There isn't the time to bring along the young associate, and as a result, the person is thrust into court handling large numbers of cases when they may not be ready to do so and haven't had adequate training. So it's all part and parcel of the same problem. I mean, you mentioned earlier the issue of funding, and of course, part of the problem here is that the economy generally has made it difficult for all manner of services to be provided by governments, and that has impacted indigent defense, much like it's impacted everything else. But providing lawyers for the poor in criminal and juvenile cases is simply not very attractive for politicians. There's a friend of mine from another state once told me the story that he talked to the county chairman of a very large metropolitan community about the county's funding for indigent defense, and the response of the county chairman was, you know, there simply just isn't a single vote in it, and that's part of the problem. Yeah. It's very difficult to attract politicians to provide adequate support, notwithstanding the fact that it may be a constitutional right declared by the U.S. Supreme Court.
We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Norman Lefstein. He's professor of law and dean emeritus of the Indiana University School of Law, Indianapolis. And we're talking about the right to counsel and how well as a nation we are fulfilling the charge of the Supreme Court that anyone charged of a crime is entitled to have an attorney, whether they can afford it or not. And if you'd like to read more about this, you go to the website of the Constitution Project and look at this report, Justice Denied, a report of the National Right to Counsel Committee. And our guest this morning, Professor Lefstein is a member of that committee. We have another caller here. Someone would like to join us, be in part of the conversation. We'll go to line one for a caller in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, it would seem to me that good arguments could be made for not having public defenders in a separate office, that the state's attorney's office would have a criminal division, and that the attorneys that are employed there would be required to take cases prosecuting and defending in alternation, and that the rules about the support of this with respect to investigators and expert witnesses and all that would be the same for both sides. It seems obvious that if the prosecutors, if the defenders on a separate office get N dollars for their work, and the prosecutors get $2 N dollars or $5 N dollars, that the cause of justice is not being well served. And one could even extend this notion to requiring that all defendants accept the lawyers that are offered to them by this system, so that even if you are rich, if you are a criminal defendant, you do not get to pick a high-class lawyer to defend you, or you have to accept the ones that are available for everyone. I could give more arguments for this, but I'll leave off and let you respond.
Well, Professor Lefstein?
Well, those are interesting interesting issues that you raise. I think in the United States the die is cast, and we're simply not going to have a system whereby lawyers switch off between prosecution and defense on any kind of a regular basis. It reminds me that a former and late Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, Warren Burger, was very enamored with that very idea of lawyers switching back and forth between prosecution and defense. But it's simply not a structure that is very feasible. We do have in this country an adversary system of justice, and it does present a lot of problems to have lawyers switching back and forth between prosecution and defense, problems of conflict of interest, of acquiring information while a prosecutor that you then might be able to use as a defense lawyer, but it is simply not something that is apt to happen in this country. At the same time, I would certainly argue, if I were writing on an absolutely clean slate, I would structure the whole system very differently than I think it's developed in the United States, though that may be a subject of a much longer discussion. The other issue you raise really has to do kind of with a concept almost of socialized legal services, because the caller was suggesting that somebody might be required to take the lawyer that was designated by the state. Two issues there. One is I don't know that we would want to deprive somebody of accepting a lawyer of their choosing for whom they had the wherewithal to pay. Moreover, the U.S. Supreme Court has declared in a decision I haven't talked about that there is not only a constitutional right to an attorney to represent you in a criminal case, but there is also a corollary right to proceed without a lawyer. In other words, to proceed on your own without legal counsel. And that was actually a decision of the U.S. Supreme Court that was hotly debated. And the court, as I recall, was not unanimous in its decision because there were some justices that were perfectly prepared to say that you shouldn't be allowed to proceed without a lawyer. But the whole notion of the assistance of counsel, the Supreme Court said, implies that it is assistance that the Constitution guarantees, and if you don't want the assistance, you've got to be allowed to proceed without a representation.
Yeah, I would have no problem with that. I think that's an entirely separate issue. But it seems to me that if the rich people can get really talented lawyers to defend them and the poor people can't, that it's obvious that the cause of justice is not being well served. And I don't see another way around it other than that the system for a defender being assigned be the same for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there is some merit to it. The late judge from the Southern District of New York, Judge Marvin Frankel, wrote a piece many years ago on that very issue and basically said that lawyers simply ought to be provided to everybody without regard to whether or not they can pay. And I think he would have retained the right for somebody who wanted to go out and hire their own, but you wouldn't have to. And I think his analogy was really to National Health Service in England and throughout Great Britain, thinking that that's a responsibility of government to assure justice, and you assure justice for everybody without regard to the ability to pay. But we can't even provide adequate funding for representation of indigent criminal defendants, let alone providing funding for everybody, even though in theory I don't disagree with you.
Okay, thank you very much.
We have just about 5 minutes left. I think we've done a good job in talking about the problem, and I know I'm not leaving you very much time, but I do want to give you the opportunity to talk about what you think and the other people who have contributed to the report that we've mentioned think we should do about this.
Well, this may be controversial in the minds of some of your listeners, but one of the two overriding recommendations in our report. One of them mirrors a recommendation of the American Bar Association that was approved by the ABA in 1979, namely that the federal government ought to assist the states and local jurisdictions in providing some funding for defense services, assuming that there is compliance with standards to make certain that the funding is used effectively. The Sixth Amendment to the Constitution is a federal guarantee of the right to counsel, but the federal government has done virtually nothing to assist state and local jurisdictions. And what has happened over time, I think, is considerable evidence that the states and local jurisdictions have been unwilling to provide adequate funding. You know, we do have a legal services corporation on the civil side where there is not a constitutional right to counsel, and I don't in any way denigrate the legal services corporation, which I think provides a very valuable function in this country. But on the criminal side and juvenile side, where there is a constitutional right to an attorney, there is no analog of any kind to what the Legal Services Corporation provides on the civil side. And the other recommendation that we make, which is a paramount recommendation, is that by and large, we think it best that programs for indigent defense be organized at a statewide level. Mm-hmm. That there be an independent, nonpartisan commission to oversee the furnishing of defense services, and that it not be left up to county governments, because we don't think that has the best likelihood of spreading the best possible defense services on a more even basis throughout a jurisdiction.
So that would somehow address this issue of that some places maybe the lawyers would be pretty good, other places not. There would be some sort of maybe a little bit better kind of quality control.
Absolutely. And we talk a lot about oversight, monitoring, supervision, and a variety of other issues in the report. The report actually contains some 22 recommendations. We could have made more, but we came out ultimately with 22, believing that these were the most vital ones that needed to be said.
Yeah. Clearly, the many jurisdictions around the country, they, and understandably, particularly now, are financially strapped. It's difficult to fund all of various services, and as you noted, there are some places where there's not a whole lot of sympathy for people who have been accused of crimes. So if what we're going to say is that that states need help from the federal government to fulfill this commitment, do you have any kind of sense of how much money we're talking about?
Well, the the amount that is now spent on indigent public defense among the 50 states is really a very small sum of money if you look at the federal budget or you look at expenditures generally in the criminal justice system. It's probably about $3.5 billion, somewhere in that range. So, you know, we talk about a stimulus bill that is, $700-800 billion. We're talking about small change by any kind of comparison that could have a dramatic impact in the area of indigent defense in the United States. When I use that figure of $3.5 billion, I'm talking about on an annual basis. If you add up all of the states and the counties, it's very hard to get firm data in this area. You take a state like Illinois, where you've got all the different counties providing defense representation, it's probably very difficult to pull together all of the expenditures for indigent defense throughout the state of Illinois.
Yeah. We're going to have to stop there. What I will say here at the end, though, if there are people who are listening and want to read more on this subject, you should look at the report we mentioned a couple of times. The title of the report is Justice Denied, America's Continuing Neglect of Our Constitutional Right to Counsel. This is a report of the National Right to Counsel Committee of the Constitution Project. And if you'd like to read it, you can go to the Constitution Project website, which is constitutionproject.org, and you can see it there. Our guest, Norman Lefstein, is a member of this committee, the National Right to Counsel Committee. He's professor of law and dean emeritus of the Indiana University School of Law, Indianapolis. And Professor Lefstein, thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure, David. I enjoy being with you this morning.